Please be advised that the views and opinions expressed by Richard Martin, Senior Vice President of Global Strategic Investments, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent those of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments made on the basis of Mr. Martin's comments are entirely unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener or investor.
Everybody, nice to be back again, and I'm Richard Martin, for those of you who just tuned in, I'm talking to you from Miami, Florida, and the phone number to call, if you want to call me privately, is 305-357-5575. I will repeat that. 305-357-5575. If you'd like to call and contact me by email, you can also do so by writing to me at rmartin@gscorporation.com. I repeat that. It is all in lowercase, please. With the word corporation written out in full. The GS stands for Global Strategic. Global Strategic Investments is the company where I work. And once again, here is my email address. And it is rmartin@gscorporation.com. Now, today particularly, I would like you to call in to the show itself. As you know, there is a facility through an 800 toll-free number for you to do this. And I would like to stimulate some kind of a conversation about the matter that we were discussing last week, which is the scandal of Chief Executive Officer compensation. I'm going to talk to you a lot about that today. It occurred to me that what I discussed last week, almost in jest, required more information. In other words, I think many people are not aware of just how egregious this whole business of executive compensation has become. So if you happen to have any constructive ideas or useful comments or questions, please do feel constrained to call me or call the station and air your views. The number here to call is 888-873-4643. Again, I repeat, 888-873-4643. Don't forget that there are archives that you can listen to if you feel that I'm talking about something which perhaps depends on something I said in another show. You really can go back into the archives and listen to some of the earlier shows and get the information. And I'm very, very gratified to see that the archives are now being updated very promptly. So the show from this time last week is already up. And I should imagine that Friday's show will be up very soon, too. So do please feel free to look at the show, to listen to the shows as well. Okay, now last week I mentioned the severance pay of 10 of the largest settlements ever made, and I had asked for some sort of comments of justification for this. I got one person to talk, but what I thought I would do today, I thought I would talk in much, much more detail about this business of compensation, because when all the chips are down and all is said and done, and you're going to find in many years' time looking back that there were enormous numbers of extremely unfair and injudicious decisions made in all kinds of areas of financial life. And executive compensation will figure very close to the top here. I'm going to start off by just enunciating four factoids about CEO compensation, which I think are fairly telling. And the first one is this. The chief executives at the biggest United States companies last year made as much money in a single day as the average worker made for the whole year. Top executives at Fortune 500 companies averaged $10.8 million in total compensation in 2006. The average worker, meanwhile, made $16.76 an hour, which worked out to $29,544 for the year. And that comes from a report called Executive Excess 2007, The Staggering Social Cost of U.S. Business Leadership. Now, you might say, there must be some sort of justification for this in terms of what these people did to earn this amount of money. But it really isn't clear, and this is one of the things I'm going to be talking about. If you take the top earner last year, then Yahoo CEO Terry Semel. Now, he got $71.7 million, chiefly in options grants. And he also cashed in $19 million worth of options. Now, that's a lot of loot. And quite frankly, from a shareholder perspective, it's tough to argue that Semel earned it. Especially when you think that now Yahoo stock is lower today than it was at the start of 2004, while the Standard & Poor's 500 index has advanced more than 30% in the same period. And Semel actually stepped down as CEO in June just because of shareholder dissatisfaction with his company's performance. And I'll be coming on to more details about, retirement compensation, which is even more egregious, which is what basically we were talking about last week. Here's the second factoid that I mentioned. The managers of the 20 top hedge funds and private equity shops made more money every 10 minutes last year on average than the average worker made for the whole year. Okay? John Cavanna, who's the director of the Institute for Policy Studies, his comment is, and I quote, "We are back to the gilded age of 100 years ago." All right, well, here's the third factoid. True, many workers got a break on July 24th when the federal minimum wage was increased from $5.15 to $5.85, which, by the way, was the first increase in the federal minimum wage in 10 years. But the minimum wage is still 7% below where it was 10 years ago, adjusted for inflation. Meanwhile, CEO pay has gone up 45%, adjusted for inflation, in the same period, according to the Executive Excess 2007 report. And the fourth factoid here is that U.S. CEOs enjoy supersized advantages in pensions and perks too. Thanks to generous contributions from their companies, CEOs of S&P 500 companies retire with an average of $10.1 million in their supplemental executive retirement plans, according to the corporate library. In contrast, only 36% of American households headed by someone over 65 even had a retirement account in 2004. Those accounts had an average value of $173,552, according to the Congressional Research Service. The top U.S. CEOs, by the way, enjoyed perks worth an average of $438,342 in 2006. And that's according to data cited in Executive Excess 2007. They got money for everything from personal travel on corporate jets to reimbursement for country club fees and taxes on bonuses. As an example, Ryland Group chief Chad Dreyer got $6.9 million worth of perks last year for benefits that included private use of his company's jet and a $5.7 million tax gross-up to cover the taxes on his stock options. All right, now, let's examine why these people are paid so much. I hope this is interesting to you, ladies and gentlemen. I think it's fascinating, and that's why I decided to pretty much spend the hour talking about this, because when you really get it that these people are just feathering each other's nests, it will become very clear to you, you know, why the rest of the economy has been left in disarray, and nobody really cares too much, you know, about the people, you know, other than for the very select few. And I think by the time I finished here today, you'll have a much fuller picture of this. So why are they paid so much? Well, apologists for highly paid CEOs argue they are merely getting the pay they deserve for their talents. Their pay is determined freely by the laws of supply and demand in the marketplace, right? Well, there might be more to it than that. For one thing, U.S. executives make three times as much as their European counterparts, even though these European bosses manage companies that are 40% bigger. The top 20 highest paid executives at U.S. public companies made $36.4 million on average last year, while the same group in Europe just got $12.5 million on average. Yet presumably companies on both continents draw from the similar talent pools in terms of education, work experience, and cultural background. If that's true, it's hard to accept the notion that rich pay in the United States is the result of a scarcity of talent. Next, CEO pay in the U.S. has grown to become 364 times the average worker's pay. It was just 40 times the average pay in 1980. It's hard to imagine that top leadership skills have grown so much scarcer in the past 27 years. Many pay analysts suspect that the bloated pay packages for United States executives are more the result of a marketplace failure than the basic laws of supply and demand from Economy 101. Exorbitant pay packages are often rewarded by board compensation committees that are too cozy with CEOs, believes Paul Hodgson, an executive compensation expert at the Corporate Library. They also fail to link pay to performance, which makes it easier for pay to spiral higher, he says. Other critics point a finger at the consulting firms that advise companies on CEO pay. The problem is they have an incentive to recommend rich pay packages because they also get paid for doing other consulting jobs for the same company. Well, you know, there are various different recommendations for the kind of things that one can do. Mostly to supporting efforts in Washington, D.C. to reform these policies. But I'm not going to go into them because, quite frankly, that as long as these egregious things happen, those forms of complaint or issues with government are going to be impotent because the financial companies will always find a way around them. They always have and they always will. So what I thought I would do is give you some examples of how very bad this is, starting with General Electric, which you may remember you probably don't remember, but in September, General Electric settled with the SEC for failing to adequately detail the retirement perks lavished on former chairman Jack Welch, who retired in 2001. Welch's lifetime benefits, which were first revealed by his soon-to-be ex-wife Jane in divorce filings, include, and I list, unlimited access to company jets, which the SEC says amounted to $1.2 million in Welch's first year of retirement, exclusive use of a New York City apartment worth $50,000 a month, a chauffeured limousine and a leased Mercedes-Benz, offices in New York and Connecticut, free consultations with estate planning and tax advisors, a personal assistant, television, fax, phone, computer, and security systems at his four homes, bodyguards for his speaking engagements and book tours. The SEC estimated that the total package was worth $2.5 million in the first year alone, and said GE should have disclosed the details in its annual reports. So how do we keep this stuff quiet? How come it takes the soon-to-be ex-wife to publicize these things in a divorce settlement for us to find out what's going on? Well, all too often, it's easy and legal for companies to bury the particulars of their executive pension and compensation plans. Some information is disclosed only in fine print on footnotes in proxy statements, while other details don't have to be revealed at all. If a perk, for example, costs the company less than $50,000 annually or makes up less than 25% of a compensation package, SEC regulations don't require disclosure. Investor advocates say companies are becoming increasingly skilled at using vague SEC regulations to hide and downplay compensation details, making it tough to discern who gets what. Well, here's another example. Delta Airlines successfully pushed its pilots into agreeing to a $1 billion in wage, benefit, and pension cuts to help stave off bankruptcy. At the same time, the airline moved the pensions of its top executives into trusts that would preserve the funds in case of a Chapter 11 filing. At most companies, the pension money would have remained a corporate asset and subject to seizure by creditors. Transferring the money to the bankruptcy-proof trusts typically triggers big tax bills for the executives, so Delta inflated the amounts to compensate for the extra taxes. Other troubled companies that have created similar trusts for executives include UAL Corp, parent of bankrupt United Airlines, and defunct steel concern, LTD Corp. Well, there's all sorts of other things sort of that they do in that regard, but I thought it might be interesting to, well, talk to Joe in New York, who just came online. Joe, hi, how are you?
Hi. Fine. How are you, Richard? I want to ask you two questions. I heard you talking on the show before this about Citibank, and I was wondering if things get really bad, don't you think the government will just bail them out?
No, I'll tell you why. No, I'll tell you why they won't bail them out. They won't bail them out because the government is going to discover very quickly that we are not any longer talking about a situation such as we had in 1998 with long-term capital management. In 1998, a big fund went bankrupt because its models could not cope with the sudden meltdown in Russia. And it was an isolated instance, Joe, and it was very simple for Greenspan to inject money into the banks to make the loans they needed to bail this company out and basically take over the positions and prevent a financial meltdown. It was simple, it was isolated, and everybody knew that, you know, it was, you know, it was contained to this one company. Now, they've tried that trick already recently. They've tried telling everybody that the subprime problem was contained. But as I heard rather amusingly, Jim Grant, who's a very brilliant analyst, saying on a show that I watched early this morning, he said, yeah, sure, the subprime problem is contained to the planet. You know, and quite frankly, that is just about where we are with this. The government couldn't possibly deal with the amount of shortfalls in the trillions of dollars that we are going to see, Joe. They couldn't handle it. It's too great. The problem is just too onerous.
So could a company like Citibank go out of business?
Could Citibank line up business?
Yeah, could it go out of business? Could it go bankrupt?
I think it will. If you actually take the notional losses to Citicorp right now, as we speak today, you know, November the 13th at 1:30 p.m. Eastern Time, Citigroup is technically bankrupt.
Mm. And so it's up $2 today.
All it takes, you know, is for people to lay claim to their debts, and it could bring the company down overnight. I mean, that's what basically, you know, happened for different reasons, but it happened to Refco from 2 years ago, and it looks like E-Trade may be in the same situation right now, and I'm afraid that you are going to see this more and more. It's what happened at Enron, for example. I mean, it's the same kind of thing. I mean, these things, it's totally unexpected. No idea what you're going to find when you wake up in the morning. And that will, of course, be the end of confidence in the system. And when you don't have confidence, then you have people running for the banks. And that's what's called a run on the bank. When people, you know, like they did in England a few weeks ago, they ran to get money out of the Northern Rock Bank because they felt that their money wasn't going to last. So, no, the answer is very definitely no. There is nothing that the government will do to bail out an individual bank. It's not going to happen. No.
So if we put our money in treasuries, even with the things that you were saying about China and everything, we're safe?
Treasuries are safe, really, because what the government will do, they'll make sure that the government's own obligations are met. Yes, it's a different thing. If the government itself puts money out there and you borrow that money, the government will pay you back, and they will print money to pay back the people they need to pay back. Yes, but they're not going to pay back companies or you know, companies which are not connected with the government. Not at all. No, it's actually even doubtful whether they will finance companies like Fannie Mae. I'm not at all sure that that's going to happen either. It's an iffy one. I'm not going to, really don't want to opine on that so much.
So that's your advice. Your advice is just to get out of everything and hold treasuries now, right?
That's right. That's exactly right. Whole treasuries, all government paper of one sort or another. Yes, absolutely, Joe.
Right. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Richard.
Not at all. We have, is it Lucino from Washington on the line? Is it Lucino? Hello? Are you there?
Luciano.
Okay. Very good, Luciano. Go ahead with your question, please.
Yes. I would like to have a recommendation from you. What a single citizen, for example, like me, that just have some savings, is in cash, I don't have debts, and I own my own property. I don't want to have to devaluate the dollar, to get hit by the dollar devaluation.
Are you a permanent resident of the United States?
No.
No.
But I'm a legal worker. Yeah, I'm an expatriate.
Okay, but you will be going back to, I'm taking it, you're Italian?
In the near future, yes.
Okay, well then you should really, I think, you should exchange your dollars for euros as quickly as you can. That's my advice to you.
All right, excellent.
Okay.
All right.
Because I don't think you're doing yourself a favor by holding the currency, which is dropping, especially when you don't even intend to live here. You're better off just putting it back into your own home currency as quickly as you can, and then buying, you know, the equivalent of whatever that you can find in terms of short-term paper, like treasury bills, in euros. That will be my advice to you, Luciano.
All right, excellent. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I have a call from Bill in West Virginia. It's not a call, actually. It's an email. And he says, "Hello, Richard. People don't understand that the pie is only so big, and that when a group gets more, it means less for everyone else, i.e. people don't get it that it affects them, that money could be better spent. Of course, it's not only top executives, but also athletes, entertainers, etc. That is why a depression must come. All excess must come out. It is really excess greed, and it's everywhere. It's why you have wake-up call. Great shows, Bill." Oh, well, thank you very much. Not a question, just a comment. But gratefully received. Thank you for it very much, Bill. Okay. I have a question from Constant Tra. I hope I'm pronouncing that right, Constant, T-R-A, Tra. And Constant writes, Thanks so much for all the information you provide on the show. I have a question. My company does not allow me to put my mandatory retirement savings in government money markets. I have the option of using a commercial money market fund or a government bond fund. I currently use a commercial money market fund, Fidelity's retirement money market fund. I was wondering if I should switch to the government bond fund, Fidelity's government income fund. Thanks and keep up the good work, Constant. Yes, I must regretfully say that you should. I know nothing about that, so it's a shot in the dark here, Constant, but I think that the situation has got to the point at which there is a very strong and increasing probability that at one point these money market funds based on commercial paper will break the buck and go below $1 a share. I wouldn't take the risk. I would go into the government bond fund. I think you'll be fine. I think over time, interest rates will fall, bond funds will rise immeasurably in value, and I think you'll come out well ahead. It is not something I recommend for people, but this person's company is playing hardball with him. He is not allowing him to put his savings in government money markets. They want him to put his savings into dangerous commercial paper-based money markets and lose his money. Well, I don't want him to do either of those things. So therefore, Constant, you've got to put your money into government paper, preferably treasury bills. Okay? So thanks very much for the question. All right. Let me now deal with Walt's question. He emailed me three minutes ago, to be precise. Hi, Richard. I have been reading a little about the carry trade in the financial press. If you have some time on your show, could you please explain what this is? What will happen to the carry trade if Japan raises interest rates? Is this another crisis waiting to happen? Thank you for all that you do to inform us. Your knowledge is greatly appreciated. Walt. Thank you, Walt. Yes, the answer is yes. It is another crisis waiting to happen. Okay, I have actually mentioned the carry trade before on the show, but it's a very simple concept, so I'm more than happy to reiterate what this actually is. Okay, now, in the United States, there is a generalized rate of interest, and it is X. In every other country, there is also a generalized rate of interest, and if they don't use the dollar, then it's going to be a different rate. It could be Y, it could be Z, it could be A, B, C, it could be anything that the economy of that particular country can support in terms of its interest rate. So, obviously, there will be some countries that have very low rates of interest and other countries that have very high rates of interest. And, for example, right now, Japan has very low rates of interest. And it so happens that New Zealand, which is a very fine, perfectly well-run economy in the first world, has very high rates, about 7%. New Zealand, by the way, being one of the countries whose bonds I would highly recommend that you buy if you are of a mind to diversify outside the U.S. dollar. However, that was just an aside, coming back to the carry trade. All right, let's say that you, as a citizen of the United States, want what you think is a very low risk but nicely profitable trade to do with your money. So you take your dollars, okay, and you borrow yen, okay, at 1%, which means that you are going to buy the yen and you're going to borrow yen with dollar collateral at your bank. Borrowing the yen, you only have to pay 1% a year in interest for the loan of the yen. Then you take the yen and you buy New Zealand dollars with that yen, as I said, paying 7%, and you invest in New Zealand dollar bonds. You are now receiving 7% in New Zealand dollar bonds. You're paying 1% to the Japanese, remember, for your Japanese money. So basically, you're making on aggregate 6% profit a year with very little risk. Well, now, of course, you do have a couple of inherent risks. One is but the value of the yen against the New Zealand dollar could appreciate dramatically while you're holding the New Zealand dollars, thereby negating the profit of your 6% because the currency has risen too high. Another problem you might have is that either the Japanese raise their rates so that you're now going to find yourself paying more than 1%, or that the New Zealanders reduce their rates so that you're going to get less than 7%. So those are risks that you run in what we call the carry trade. That is an example of the carry trade, where you are carrying yen into New Zealand dollars for the purpose of getting a higher rate on your borrowed money. And when it is said that the carry trade is unwinding, that means that the process is reversed, that all of the things I described go into reverse. That could be because the people who now hold New Zealand dollars are panicking and they want to buy back their yen quickly because they fear that the yen interest rates are going to rise. So by buying back the yen from New Zealand dollars, they push up the exchange rate of the yen to the New Zealand dollars, which you don't want to see happen. It was one of your fears, remember, of things that could go wrong. It could also coincide with the Japanese putting up interest rates because they fear inflation or whatever. So it's not entirely risk-free, but it has worked out very well over the last few years, that trade. And not only with New Zealand. The United States has benefited too. You know, rates are quite high in this country, not as high as New Zealand, but they're high. There are other countries also which have very high interest rates, which are not unreliable countries like, say, Zimbabwe, which probably has 70-80% rates, but then their currency depreciates by, you know, several hundred percent a day anyway. So you want to ignore that. But anyway, I hope I've answered your question, Walt. That's a little bit on the carry trade there. All right, so looks like we've run out of questions, so it's back to the most overpaid CEOs in America. And let us take the case of Richard Parsons, who is chief executive and chairman of Time Warner. He is paid by the shareholders to make his numbers, you know, so that the stock price goes up and the shareholders are rewarded. Well, unfortunately for the shareholders of Time Warner, Parsons has failed badly. He's been CEO since May the 16th, 2002, during which time the stock has advanced 16% compared with a 44% for the S&P 500 index. Time Warner stock also lost 31% in the 5 years ending in December 2006. Well, despite having missed his numbers big time, at least from a shareholder perspective, Parsons has collected a juicy cash bonus of $7.5 million to $8.5 million in each of the past 4 years. Minus taxes, the $32 million in bonuses for 2003 to 2006 that Time Warner's board has lavished on Parsons, even though he let shareholders down, would cover 4 years' worth of state school tuition for about 1,000 students. Throw in other compensation, and Parsons has collected a whopping $53 million in the 5 years ending May the 31st, even though shareholders only saw gains of 17% compared with the S&P 500 gains of 43%. Well, how about the payouts from Dell? Michael Dell, who, as you know, has been chairman of the troubled computer maker for the past several years, booked an astonishing $153 million gain in the company's 2006 fiscal year by exercising options. That's enough to buy each of the nation's incoming freshmen a laptop for the next 38 years at current prices. Well, the prior year, Dell reported that former CEO Kevin Rollins netted $39 million, chiefly by exercising and cashing out a huge number of options in 2004. All told, the two got at least $281 million in the past 5 years while at the helm of the company. Dell's stock has slipped 1.7% in that time, compared with 43% gains for the S&P 500. Hodgson's total excludes option gains realized by Rollins when he was president and chief operating officer, like the $36 million he got in the 12 months leading up to July 2004 when he became CEO. How about Eli Lilly, CEO Sidney Taurel, pulling down huge amounts of pay for lousy performance, at least from a shareholder's perspective? He made $10.8 million last year, $43.7 million in the past 5 years, according to the Corporate Library Report. Yet shareholders have gained only 3% in the past 5 years, compared with the 43% gain for the S&P. Well, here are a couple of other examples of companies that have rewarded CEOs for really poor performance, namely Ford Motor. Paid chief executives William Ford Jr. and Alan Mulally, who took over as CEO last September, $46.8 million over the past 5 years. Mulally got $19.5 million last year just for signing on. Ford stock declined 41% in the 5 years up to the end of last year. Ford responds, as they all do, it had to pay Mulally that much to entice him away from his job at Boeing. Huh? Walmart CEO H. Lee Scott earned $65.3 million in the past 5 years. He got a $4 million bonus in each of the past 4 years for improvements in pre-tax profits. Improvements that haven't meant much to investors because Walmart stocks declined 15.5% in the 5 years through the end of last year. Oh, well, how about the appetizers? How's this for a great part-time job? $200,000 pay package and a $5,000 a year wine allowance? Yep, that's the deal given independent directors at UST Inc., which sells tobacco and wine. Chairman and former chief executive Vincent Gira got $6,500 for his wine allowance, despite making more than $6 million. The company says the wine has to flow freely to, quote, foster use of the company's wine products at events supported by such directors. But shouldn't they want to do that anyway, asks Michelle Leader of footnoted.org, which regularly exposes lavish corporate perks. Motorola executives get personal health coaches. Motorola says it provides the coaches, quote, because the health of our executives is critical to driving Motorola's success, end of quote. The company also says it, quote again, provides various levels of health coaching benefits to all of its U.S. employees, not just senior executives, end of quote. You'd think Motorola's top managers could fit the bill for their health coaches on their own. Last year, the six top executives each made between $2.5 million and the $11.8 million in salary and other compensation pulled down by CEO Edward Zander. Well, how about some travel perks? Like some travel perks? Well, here we go. This is what we have for you. If you belong to i2 Technologies and you are CEO and your name is Michael McGrath, you had one of the most Weibo corporate jet perks last year. The software company paid $942,000 to shuttle him back and forth from his home in Maine and his office in Dallas during the year. McGrath earned $5.7 million in salary, bonus and options, so he had enough for decent seats in first class, wouldn't you think? Shareholders also footed the $69,000 tax bill on the value of the flights and other perks. In corporate filings, the company claims it has to offer this perk to, quote, attract a CEO of the caliber of Mr. McGrath. United Technologies CEO George David wasn't far behind. His shareholders forked out $612,000 in 2006 for his personal use of the corporate jet. He made more than $27 million in salary bonus and stock grants and pension benefits. Back to Time Warner again. and that's Chief Wayne Pace, is allowed to use the corporate jet to fly between his workplace in New York City and his residence in Atlanta at a cost of $512,000 a year last year. Shareholders footed the bill, even though Pace made nearly $9 million in salary, bonus, and other incentive pay. Time Warner says the corporate jet benefits are, quote, consistent with the competitive market, end of quote. American Express chief executive Kenneth Chenault got $405,000 worth of personal use of corporate aircraft last year, despite making $29.1 million. His personal use of company-owned cars cost shareholders $132,000. Well, believe it or not, if you're lucky enough and you belong to the right crowd, you get your tax paid, too. You may have felt the tax man took too much when you filed your income tax returns recently. Many CEOs don't have that problem because boards grant them tax gross-ups that cover the taxes on everything from perks to retirement contributions. Liberty Media shareholders last year chipped in $319,278 to help Chairman John Malone pay his taxes. Malone might have been able to deal with Uncle Sam on his own since he made $4 million last year in salary bonus options and other pay and got $500,000 for personal expenses, upped to $1 million this year. And I quote from McGurn, quote, that's just adding insult to injury, especially when you're grossing up the perks themselves. It's not enough to make it a giveaway, but they have to make it a cost-free one as well. Robert from North Carolina, welcome to Richard Martin's Wake Up Call. What can
Hello, you Richard, how are you?
I'm just dandy, thank you.
Good. Last week you were talking about the bankruptcy laws and how they've changed for the better for the corporations and, you know, at the expense of the, you know, the working class citizens. I was wondering if you knew what those laws were.
Just a second. Let me just clarify that. They were changed for the benefit of the banks that ran the credit cards. In other words, in order to make credit card debts payable even after bankruptcy. That was the idea of the change. The laws were actually written by the credit card companies. Sorry to interrupt you, Robert. Carry on.
No problem. So so that leaves us now having to pay those bets. But do you know what the real law is and what that really means for somebody that is coming down on hard times and they may have to foreclose on their properties and then they'll end up with the credit cards, which they may have to also let go of, and possibly they're not going to be able to let go of them?
Well, yes. I mean, what it actually means is that they can declare bankruptcy in the normal way, but their credit card debts will not be discharged in bankruptcy. There are already a couple of things. I can't remember what they are. I think one of them is student loans, which are not dischargeable in bankruptcy, and they never were. And it appears that now added to those select few items which had to be paid, even post-bankruptcy, are to be included credit card debts. So I guess, you know, a judge in bankruptcy will simply create a schedule for the unfortunate bankrupt to pay his credit card debts proportionately over time as and when. I mean, you know, each case is different, but the thrust of this whole thing is that they will be payable. Yes, absolutely, Robert.
So I've noticed a lot more credit card applications come into my door, and then they said yes over the last couple of years quite a bit more, and they upped the limits quite a bit more. So they were a lot freer giving the money out with all kinds of perks and deals, you know, with all these clauses that if you don't pay every single bill on time, they'll go to a default rate, which is like an astronomical 20 to 30%. I guess that's all legal, right?
Well, it's all legal and, you know, supported by the new bankruptcy laws because they know they'll get paid. They know they've got nothing to fear. So, yes, it's not an illegal, but it's basically encouraged. It's absurd. You know? So, yes, you're absolutely right. You sort of understood it kind of well, really. Thank you very much for the call.
Thank you, Richard. You're doing a great job there. I didn't take your advice early on, and I'm suffering a little bit, but I've taken your advice lately, and it's been right on the money. And I think North Carolina is one of the few states that's still doing fairly well, but you know, the wake-up call is there, and I do appreciate your help.
Appreciate it. Thank you. Bye-bye now. Okay, what do we have here? We have Tonus Bolonus. Huh. Interesting. Oh, Tony McConnell. Tony, I ask you, please, Tonus Bolonus. Oh, well, never mind. Hi, Richard. Okay. I'm reading Tony's email. The problem is that the board and not the shareholders get to vote the CEO compensation. The setup of a publicly traded company is explicitly geared to siphoning money of a greedy public and putting it in the hands of the executives. The people on the board are in a small club and are often on multiple boards. Of course they vote their cronies a massive raise. They get a handsome cut, and when they get to play CEO, the other board members return the favor. As long as the share price goes up by whatever machinations, no matter how damaging to the long-term prospects of the company, the workers and the environment, the CEO is considered to have done his job. The average shareholder is happy to see the price go up, so he doesn't complain. Shareholders are entirely complicit in this cult of dysfunctional personality. The only time they complain is when the whole thing crashes and they see the price go down. It's quite simply a racket. Price is no indication of value. This is indeed a crisis of capitalism. Thank you, Tony. I couldn't have put it better myself. Very eloquent and to the point. Excellent focus there. And I have actually said the same thing in previous talks, that when you're going up the hill, everybody's happy. But when you go over the top of the hill and you start coming down the other side, and the markets implode, and the Enrons, you know, collapse, and the Adelphis and all the other floss out there, people turn around and they want a scapegoat. And that's when all the lawsuits start flying. And in a sense, people have only themselves to blame. And as you rightly point out, shareholders are indeed entirely complicit in this cult of dysfunctional personality. You know, there really isn't much that they can do, you know. The real culprits behind these enormous salary increases for CEOs are the boards that approve these egregious pay packages. You know, so really, it's important to vote against board members on pay committees that let these bloated pay packages through. You know, unless you boot off the directors who agree to these outrageous pay plans, there is no way to stop it. You know, as a shareholder, you can ask companies to put pay-related reforms to a vote, or at least be sure to look for pay-related proposals from other activist shareholders and vote yes. You know. Watch for proposals asking you to vote against excessive golden parachutes, excessive pay packages, and the compensation committee reports that justify them. You know? You know, proposals that require majority voting for directors are crucial. This change means that directors have to get a majority of all votes cast to win, not just the largest number among several candidates. It makes it harder for boards and managers to get a rubber stamp on their favored candidates when the broad shareholder base is apathetic. So, I mean, there are things that you can do, but, you know, you have to be proactive, and it has to stop. And it will, because, I mean, people, you know, the markets are going to implode soon anyway, and people just aren't going to stand for it any longer. So I've given you some ideas. I mean, I've got lots more stuff here. You know, basically, I don't know whether $890,000 worth of professional race car driving instruction for the kids of an executive who served 32 years at a company deserves, you know, some kind of a report. But that's what the CEO William Butler Jr., furniture rental chain Aaron Rents executive, he was the director and president of sales. That's what he got for his kids. Nice work if you can get it, I say. You know, I mean, basically, it just goes on. I mean, it's so egregious, it's so awful, that it's almost amusing. And it would be funny if it were not so very, very serious. Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your time. Thank you for listening. I hope you're having a good week, and hope it remains that way up until Friday, when, of course, you will be back at 1 p.m. to listen to another edition of Richard Martin's Wake Up Call. With that, I wish you goodbye, good luck, and see you then. Take care.